With great care, she concentrated on crafting the glyph she had composed earlier in the day. She had named it Kiipithia, a plea out of love, to be allowed to face danger at love's side. Her tendrils trembled above her ears, and the construct quavered slightly over her head as it began to rotate. Finally, though, it stabilized. She sent it, drifting over toward her father's aura. At that moment, Athaklana did not even care that they were in a room crowded with hulking, smooth-browed humans and their furry little chim clients. All that mattered in the world was the two of them, and the bridge she so longed to build across this void. Kiipithia fell into Utha Calding's waiting tendrils and spun there, brightening in his appreciation. Briefly, Athaklana gasped at its sudden beauty, which she knew had now grown far beyond her own simple art. Then the glyph fell, like a gentle fog of morning dew, to coat and shine along her father's corona. "Such a fine gift!" His voice was soft, and she knew he had been moved. But she knew all at once that his resolve was unshifted. "I offer you a kenning of my own," he said to her. And from his sleeve he withdrew a small gilt box with a silver clasp. "Your mother, Matha Kluana, wished for you to have this when you were ready to declare yourself of age. Although we had not yet spoken of a date, I judge that now is the time for you to have it." Athaklana blinked, suddenly lost in a whirl of confused emotions. How often had she longed to know what her dead mother had left in her legacy? And yet, right now, the small locket might have been a poisoned beetle for all the will she had to pick it up. Utha Calding would not be doing this if he thought it likely they would meet again. She hissed in realization. "You're planning to fight!" Utha Calding actually shrugged, that human gesture of momentary indifference. "The enemies of the humans are mine as well, daughter. The earthlings are bold, but they are only wolflings, after all. They will need my help." There was finality in his voice, and Athaklana knew that any further word of protest would accomplish nothing but to make her look foolish in his eyes. Their hands met around the locket, long fingers intertwining, and they walked silently out of the room together. It seemed for a short span as if they were not two, but three, for the locket carried something of Matha Kluana. The moment was both sweet and painful. Neo-chimp militia guards snapped to attention and opened the doors for them as they stepped out of the ministry building and into the clear, early spring sunshine. Utha Calding accompanied Athaklana down to the curbside, where her backpack awaited her. Their hands parted, and Athaklana was left grasping her mother's locket.
"Here comes Robert, right on time," Utha Calding said, shading his eyes. "His mother calls him unpunctual, but I have never known him to be late for anything that mattered."
A battered floater wagon approached along the long gravel driveway, rolling past limousines and militia staff cars. Utha Calding turned back to his daughter.
"Do try to enjoy the mountains of Mulan. I have seen them. They are quite beautiful. Look at this as an opportunity, Athaklana."
She nodded.
"I shall do as you asked, father. I'll spend the time improving my grasp of Anglic and of wolfling emotional patterns."
"Good. And keep your eyes open for any signs or traces of the legendary Garthlings."
Athaklana frowned. Her father's late interest in odd wolfling folk tales had lately begun to resemble a fixation. And yet, one could never tell when Utha Calding was being serious, or simply setting up a complicated jest.
I'll watch out for signs, though the creatures are certainly mythical.
Utha Calling smiled. I must go now. My love will travel with you. It will be a bird, hovering. He motioned with his hands. Just over your shoulder. His tendrils touched hers briefly, and then he was gone, striding back up the steps to rejoin the worried colonials. Athaclena was left standing there. Wondering why, in parting, Utha Calling had used such a bizarre human metaphor.
How can love be a bird?
Sometimes Utha Calling was so strange it frightened even her. There was a crunching of gravel as the floater car settled down at the curb nearby. Robert Oneagle, the dark-haired young human who was to be her partner in exile, grinned and waved from behind the machine's tiller. But it was easy to tell that his cheery demeanor was superficial, put on for her benefit. Deep down, Robert was nearly as unhappy about this trip as she was. Fate, and the imperious rule of adults, had thrown the two of them together in a direction neither of them would have chosen. The crude glyph Athaclena formed, invisible to Robert, was little more than a sigh of resignation and defeat. But she kept up appearances with a carefully arranged earthling-type smile of her own.
"Hello, Robert,"
she said, and picked up her pack. Chapter 3 Galactics. The suzerain of propriety fluffed its feathery down, displaying at the roots of its still white plumage the shimmering glow that foretold royalty. Proudly, the suzerain of propriety hopped up onto the perch of pronouncement and chirped for attention. The battleships of the expeditionary force were still in interspace between the levels of the world. Battle was not imminent for some time yet. Because of this, the suzerain of propriety was still dominant and could interrupt the activities of the flagship's crew. Across the bridge, the suzerain of Beam and Talon looked up from its own perch of command. The admiral shared with the suzerain of propriety the bright plumage of dominance. Nevertheless, there was no question of interfering when a religious pronouncement was about to be made. The admiral at once interrupted the stream of orders it had been chirping to subordinates and shifted into a stance of attentive reverence. All through the bridge, the noisy clamor of Goobru engineers and spacers quieted to a low chittering. Their four-footed Quacku clients ceased their cooing as well and settled down to listen. Still, the suzerain of propriety waited. It would not be proper to begin until all three were present. A hatchway dilated. In stepped the last of the masters of the expedition, the third member of the triarchy. As appropriate, the suzerain of cost and caution wore the black torque of suspicion and doubt as it entered and found a comfortable perch, followed by a small covey of its accountants and bureaucrats. For a moment their eyes met across the bridge. The tension among the three had already begun, and it would grow in the weeks and months ahead, until the day when consensus was finally achieved, when they molted and a new queen emerged. It was thrilling, sexual, exhilarating. None of them knew how it would end. Beam and Talon started with an advantage, of course, since this expedition would begin in battle. But that dominance did not have to last. This moment, for instance, was clearly one for the priesthood. All brakes turned as the suzerain of propriety lifted and flexed one leg, then the other, and prepared to pronounce. Soon a low crooning began to rise from the assembled avians.
Zoon. We embark on a mission, holy mission,
the suzerain fluted.
Zoon. Embarking on this mission, we must persevere. Zoon. Persevere to accomplish 4 great tasks. Zoon. Tasks which include conquest for the glory of our clan. Zoon. Zoon. Conquest and coercion, so we may gain the secret that the animal earthlings clutch talon tight, clutch to keep from us. Zoon. Zoon. Conquest, coercion, and counting coup upon our enemies, winning honor, and submitting our foes to shame, avoiding shame ourselves. Zoon. Zoon. Avoiding shame as well as conquest and coercion, and last, to prove our worthiness. Our worthiness before our ancestrals. Our worthiness before the progenitors whose time of return has surely come. Our worthiness of mastery. Zoon. The refrain was enthusiastic. Zoon. The 2 other suzerains bowed respectfully to the priest, and the ceremony was officially at an end. The Talon soldiers and spacers returned to work at once, but as the bureaucrats and civil servants retreated toward their own sheltered offices, they could be heard clearly but softly crooning.
All, all, all of that, but one thing more. First of all, survival of the nest.
The priest looked up sharply and saw a glint in the eye of the suzerain of cost and caution, and in that instant it knew that its rival had won a subtle but important point. There was triumph in the other's eye as it bowed again and hummed lowly, Zoon. Chapter 4. Robert. Dappled sunlight found gaps in the rainforest canopy, illuminating streaks of brilliant color in the dim, vine-laced avenue between. The fierce gales of midwinter had ebbed some weeks back, but a stiff breeze served as a reminder of those days, causing boughs to dip and sway, and shaking loose moisture from the prior night's rain. Droplets made fat, plinking sounds as they landed in little shaded pools. It was quiet in the mountains overlooking the Vale of Sindh, perhaps more silent than a forest ought to be. The woods were lush, and yet their superficial beauty masked a sickness, a malaise arising from ancient wounds. Though the air carried a wealth of fecund odors, one of the strongest was a subtle hint of decay. It did not take an empath to know that this was a sad place, a melancholy world. Indirectly, that sadness was what had brought earthlings here. History had not yet written the final chapter on Garth, but the planet was already on a list of dying worlds. One shaft of daylight spotlighted a fan of multicolored vines, dangling in apparent disorder from the branches of a giant tree. Robert Onigle pointed in that direction.
"You might want to examine those, Athaclena," he said. "They can be trained, you know."
The young Timbrimi looked up from an orchid-like bloom she had been inspecting. She followed his gesture, peering past the bright, slanting columns of light. She spoke carefully in accented but clearly enunciated Anglic.
"What can be trained, Robert? All I see there are vines."
Robert grinned. "Those very forest vines, Athaclena. They're amazing things." Athaclena's frown looked very human, in spite of the wide set of her oval eyes and the alien gold-flecked green of their large irises.
Her slightly curved, delicate jaw and angled brow made the expression appear faintly ironic. Of course, as the daughter of a diplomat, Athaclena might have been taught to assume carefully tutored expressions at certain times when in the company of humans. Still, Robert was certain her frown conveyed genuine puzzlement. When she spoke, a lilt in her voice seemed to imply that Anglic was somehow limiting.
"Robert, you surely don't mean that those hanging tendril plants are presentient, do you? There are a few autotrophic sophant races, of course, but this vegetation shows none of the signs. Anyway..."
The frown intensified as she concentrated. From a fringe just above her ears, her timbrimy ruff quivered as silvery tendrils waved in quest.
"Anyway, I can sense no emotional emissions from them at all."
Robert grinned. "No, of course you can't. I didn't mean to imply they have any uplift potential, or even nervous systems, per se. They're just rainforest plants. But they do have a secret. Come on, I'll show you." Athaclena nodded, another human gesture that might or might not be naturally timbrimy as well. She carefully replaced the flower she had been examining and stood up in a fluid, graceful movement. The alien girl's frame was slender, the proportions of her arms and legs different from the human norm, longer calves and less length in the thighs, for instance. Her slim, articulated pelvis flared from an even narrower waist. To Robert, she seemed to prowl in a faintly cat-like manner that had fascinated him ever since she arrived on Garth half a year ago. That the Timbrimi were lactating mammals, he could tell by the outline of her upper breasts, provocatively evident even under her soft trail suit. He knew from his studies that Athaclena had two more pair, and a marsupial-like pouch as well. But those were not evident at present. Right now she seemed more human, or perhaps elfin, than alien.
"All right, Robert. I promised my father I would make the best of this enforced exile. Show me more of the wonders of this little planet."
The tone of her voice was so heavy, so resigned, that Robert decided she had to be exaggerating for effect. The theatrical touch made her seem oddly more like a human teenager, and that in itself was a bit unnerving. He led her toward the cluster of vines. "It's over here, where they converge, down at the forest floor." Athaclena's ruff, the helm of brown fur that began in a narrow stroke of down on her spine and rose up the back of her neck to end cap-like in a widow's peak above the bridge of her strong nose, was now puffed and riffled at the edges. Over her smooth, softly rounded ears, the cilia of her timbrimy corona waved, as if she were trying to pick out any trace of consciousness other than theirs in the narrow glade. Robert reminded himself not to overrate timbrimy mental powers, as humans so often did. The slender galactics did have impressive abilities in detecting strong emotions, and were supposed to have a talent for crafting a form of art out of empathy itself. Nevertheless, true telepathy was no more common among timbrimy than among Earthlings. Robert had to wonder what she was thinking. Could she know how, since they had left Port Helenia together, his fascination with her had grown? He hoped not. The feeling was one he wasn't sure he even wanted to admit to himself yet. The vines were thick, fibrous strands with knotty protrusions every half meter or so. They converged from many different directions upon this shallow forest clearing. Robert shoved a cluster of the multicolored cables aside to show Athaclena that all of them terminated in a single, small pool of umber-colored water. He explained, "These ponds are found all over this continent, each connected to the others by this vast network of vines.
They play a vital role in the rainforest ecosystem. No other shrubs grow near these catchments where the vines do their work.
Athaclena knelt to get a better view. Her corona still waved, and she seemed interested.
Why is the pool colored so? Is there an impurity in the water?
Yes, that's right. If we had an analysis kit, I could take you from pond to pond and demonstrate that each little puddle has a slight overabundance of a different trace element or chemical. The vines seem to form a network among the giant trees, carrying nutrients abundant in one area to other places where they're lacking.
A trade compact.
Athaclena's ruff expanded in one of the few purely Tim Brimmy expressions Robert was certain he understood. For the first time since they had left the city together, he saw her clearly excited by something. He wondered if she was at that moment crafting an empathy glyph, that weird art form that some humans swore they could sense and even learn to understand a little. Robert knew the feathery tendrils of the Timbrimi corona were involved in the process somehow. Once, while accompanying his mother to a diplomatic reception, he'd noticed something that had to have been a glyph, floating, it seemed, above the ruff of the Timbrimi ambassador, Utha Calving. It had been a strange, fleeting sensation, as if he had caught something which could only be looked at with the blind spot of his eye, which fled out of view whenever he tried to focus on it. Then, as quickly as he had become aware of it, the glimpse vanished. In the end, he was left unsure it had been anything but his imagination after all.
"The relationship is symbiotic, of course,"
Athaclena pronounced. Robert blinked. She was talking about the vines, of course.
Right again. The vines take nourishment from the great trees, and in exchange they transport nutrients the trees' roots can't draw out of the poor soil. They also flush out toxins and dispose of them at great distances. Pools like this one serve as banks where the vines come together to stockpile and trade important chemicals.
Incredible.
Athaclena examined the rootlets.
It mimics the self-interest trade patterns of sentient beings, and I suppose it is logical that plants would evolve this technique, sometime, somewhere. I believe the Kantan might have begun in such a way, before the Linton gardeners uplifted them and made them starfarers.
She looked up at Robert.
Is this phenomenon catalogued? The Zitang were supposed to have surveyed Garth for the Institutes before the planet was passed over to you humans. I'm surprised I never heard of this.
Robert allowed himself a trace of a smile. Sure, the Zitang report to the Great Library mentions the vine's chemical transfer properties. A part of the tragedy of Garth was that the network seemed on the verge of total collapse before Earth was granted a leasehold here. And if that actually happens, half this continent will turn into desert.
But the Zitang missed something crucial. They never seemed to have noticed that the vines move about the forest, very slowly, seeking new minerals for their host trees. The forest, as an active trading community, adapts. It changes. There's actual hope that, with the right helpful nudge here and there, the network might become a centerpiece in the recovery of the planet's ecosphere. If so, we may be able to make a tidy profit selling the technique to certain parties elsewhere.
He had expected her to be pleased, but when Athaclena let the rootlets fall back into the umber water, she turned to him with a cool tone.
You sound proud to have caught so careful and intellectual an elder race as the Zitang in a mistake, Robert. As one of your teledramas might put it, the ETs and their library are caught with egg on their faces once again. Is that it?
Now, wait a minute,
Tell me, do you humans plan to hoard this information, gloating over your cleverness each time you dole out portions? Or will you flaunt it, crying far and wide what any race with sense already knows, that the great library is not, and never has been, perfect.
Robert winced. The stereotypical Tim Brimmy, as pictured by most Earthlings, was adaptable, wise, and often mischievous. But right now, Athaclena sounded more like any irritable, opinionated young femme with a chip on her shoulder. True, some Earthlings went too far in criticizing galactic civilization. As the first known wolfling race in over 50 mega-years, humans sometimes boasted too loudly that they were the only species now living who had bootstrapped themselves into space without anybody's help. What need had they to take for granted everything found in the great library of the five galaxies? Terran popular media tended to encourage an attitude of contempt for aliens who would rather look things up than find out for themselves. There was a reason for encouraging this stance. The alternative, according to Terrigan's psychological scientists, would be a crushing racial inferiority complex. Pride was a vital thing for the only backward clan in the known universe. It stood between humanity and despair. Unfortunately, the attitude had also alienated some species who might otherwise have been friendly to mankind. But on that count, were Athaclena's people all that innocent? The Timbrimi also were famed for finding loopholes in tradition, and for not being satisfied with what was inherited from the past.
"When will you humans learn that the universe is dangerous, that there are many ancient and powerful clans who have no love of upstarts, especially newcomers who brashly set off changes without understanding the likely consequences?"
Now Robert knew what Athaclena was referring to, what the real source of this outburst was. He rose from the poolside and dusted his hands. "Look, neither of us really knows what's going on out there in the galaxy right now. But it's hardly our fault that a dolphin-crewed starship,
the Streaker
happened to discover something bizarre, something overlooked all these eons. Anyone could have stumbled onto it. Hell, Athaclena, we don't even know what it was those poor neo-dolphins found. Last anyone heard, their ship was being chased from the Morgan transfer point to Ifni knows where by 20 different fleets, all fighting over the right to capture her." Robert discovered his pulse was beating hard. Clenched hands indicated just how much of his own tension was rooted in this topic. After all, it is frustrating enough whenever your universe threatens to topple in on you. But all the more so when the events that set it all off took place kilo parsecs away, amid dim red stars too distant even to be seen from home. Athaclena's dark-lidded eyes met his, and for the first time he felt he could sense a touch of understanding in them. Her long-fingered left hand performed a fluttering half-turn.
"I hear what you are saying, Robert. And I know that sometimes I am too quick to cast judgments. It is a fault my father constantly urges me to overcome. But you ought to remember that we Timbrimi have been Earth's protectors and allies ever since your great lumbering slow ships stumbled into our part of space 89 Pactars ago. It grows wearying at times, and you must forgive if on occasion it shows."
"What grows wearying?" Robert was confused.
"Well, for one thing, ever since contact, we have had to learn and endure this assemblage of wolfling clicks and growls you have the effrontery to call a language."
Athaclena's expression was even, but now Robert believed he could actually sense a faint something emanating from those waving tendrils. It seemed to convey what a human girl might communicate with a subtle facial expression. Clearly, she was teasing him. "Ha, ha, very funny." He looked down at the ground.
Seriously, though, Robert, have we not, in the 7 generations since contact, constantly urged that you humans and your clients go slow? The Streaker simply should not have been prying into places where she did not belong, not while your small clan of races is still so young and helpless. You cannot keep on poking at the rules to see which are rigid and which are soft.
Robert shrugged. That's paid off a few times.
Yes, but now your... what is the proper beastly idiom? Your cows have come home to roost? Robert, the fanatics won't let go now that their passions are aroused. They will chase the dolphin ship until she is captured. And if they cannot acquire her information that way, powerful clans, such as the Jofer and the Sorrow, will seek other means to achieve their ends.
Dust motes sparkled gently in and out of the narrow shafts of sunlight. Scattered pools of rainwater glinted where the beams touched them. In the quiet, Robert scuffed at the soft humus, knowing all too well what Athaclena was driving at. The Jofer, the Sorrow, the Gubru, the Tandu, those powerful galactic patron races which had time and again demonstrated their hostility to mankind. If they failed to capture Streaker, their next step would be obvious. Sooner or later, some clan would turn its attention to Garth, or At Last, or Calafia, Earth's most distant and unprotected outposts, seeking hostages in an effort to pry loose the dolphin's mysterious secret. The tactic was even permissible under the loose strictures established by the ancient Galactic Institute for Civilized Warfare. Some civilization, Robert thought bitterly. The irony was that the dolphins weren't even likely to behave as any of the stodgy galactics expected them to. By tradition, a client race owed allegiance and fealty to its patrons, the star-faring species that had uplifted it to full sentience. This had been done for pan-chimpanzees and tersiops dolphins by humans even before contact with star-faring aliens. In doing so, mankind had unknowingly mimicked a pattern that had ruled the 5 galaxies for perhaps 3 billion years. By tradition, client species served their patrons for 1,000 centuries or more, until release from indenture freed them to seek clients of their own. Few galactic clans believed or understood how much freedom had been given dolphins and chims by the humans of Earth. It was hard to say exactly what the Neo-Dolphins on the Streaker's crew would do if humans were taken hostage. But that apparently wouldn't stop the ETs from trying. Distant listening posts had already confirmed the worst. Battle fleets were coming, approaching Garth, even as he and Athaclena stood here talking.
"Which is worth more, Robert?" Athaclena asked softly. "That collection of ancient space hulks the dolphins are supposed to have found, derelicts that have no meaning at all to a clan as young as yours? Or your worlds, with their farms and parks and orbit cities? I cannot understand the logic of your Terrigan's Council, ordering Streaker to guard her secret, when you and your clients are so vulnerable."
Robert looked down at the ground again. He had no answer for her. It did sound illogical when looked at in that way. He thought about his classmates and friends gathering now to go to war without him, to fight over issues none of them understood. It was hard. For Athaclena, it would be as bad, of course, banished from her father's side, trapped on a foreign world by a quarrel that had little or nothing to do with her. Robert decided to let her have the last word. She had seen more of the universe than he anyway, and had the advantage of coming from an older, higher-status clan. "Maybe you're right," he said.
"Maybe you're right."
Perhaps, though, he reminded himself as he helped her lift her backpack
and then hoisted his own for the next stage of their trek. Perhaps a young Tim Brimmy can be just as ignorant and opinionated as any human youth, a little frightened and far away from home.
Chapter 5 Fibbin
TAASF Scout Ship Bonneball calling Scout Ship Proconsul. Fibbin, you're out of alignment again. Come on, old Chim, try to straighten her out, will you?
Fibbin wrestled with the controls of his ancient, alien-built spacecraft. Only the open mic kept him from expressing his frustration in rich profanity. Finally, in desperation, he kicked the makeshift control panel the technicians had installed back on Garth. That did it. A red light went out as the anti-gravity verniers suddenly unfroze. Fibbin sighed. At last. Of course, in all the exertion, his faceplate had steamed up.
You'd think they'd come up with a decent ape suit after all this time,
he grumbled as he turned up the defogger. It was more than a minute before the stars reappeared.
What was that, Fibbin? What'd you say? I said I'll have this old crate lined up in time, he snapped. The ETs won't be disappointed.
The popular slang term for alien galactics had its roots in an acronym for extraterrestrials, but it also made Fibbin think about food. He had been living on ship paste for days, what he wouldn't give for a fresh chicken and palm leaf sandwich right now. Nutritionists were always after Chims to curb their appetite for meat, said too much was bad for the blood pressure. Fibbin sniffed.
Heck, I'd settle for a jar of mustard in the latest edition of the Port Helena Times, he thought. Say, Fibbin, you're always up on the latest scuttlebutt. Has anyone figured out yet who's invading us? Well, I know a chimney in the coordinator's office who told me she had a friend on the intelligence staff who thought the bastards were Sorrow, or maybe Tandu.
Tandu? You're kidding, I hope. Simon sounded aghast, and Fibbin had to agree. Some thoughts just weren't to be contemplated.
Ah, well, my guess is it's probably just a bunch of Linton gardeners dropping by to make sure we're treating the plants all right.
Simon laughed, and Fibbin felt glad. Having a cheerful wingman was worth more than a reserve officer's half pay. He got his tiny space skiff back onto its assigned trajectory. The scout boat, purchased only a few months back from a passing Zatini scrap hauler, was actually quite a bit older than his own sapient race. While his ancestors were still harassing baboons beneath African trees, this fighter had seen action under distant suns, controlled by the hands, claws, tentacles of other poor creatures, similarly doomed to skirmish and die in pointless interstellar struggles. Fibbin had only been allowed 2 weeks to study schematics and remember enough Galactoscript to read the instruments. Fortunately, designs changed slowly in the eons-old galactic culture, and there were basics most spacecraft shared in common. One thing was certain. Galactic technology was impressive. Humanity's best ships were still bought, not Earth-made. And although this old tub was creaky and cranky, it would probably outlive him this day. All around Fibbin, bright fields of stars glittered, except where the inky blackness of the Spoon Nebula blotted out the thick band of the galactic disk. That was the direction where Earth lay, the home world Fibbin had never seen, and now probably never would. Garth, on the other hand, was a bright green spark only 3 million kilometers behind him. Her tiny fleet was too small to cover the distant hyperspatial transfer points, or even the inner system. Their ragged array of scouts, meteoroid miners, and converted freighters, plus 3 modern corvettes, was hardly adequate to cover the planet itself. Fortunately, Fibbin wasn't in command, so he did not have to keep his mind on the forlorn state of their prospects. He had only to do his duty and wait. Contemplating annihilation was not how he planned to spend the time. He tried to divert himself by thinking about the Throop family, the small sharing clan on Quintana Island that had recently invited him to join in their group marriage. For a modern Chim, it was a serious decision, like when two or three human beings decided to marry and raise a family. He had been pondering the choice for weeks. The Throop clan did have a nice rambling house, good grooming habits, and respectable professions. The adults were attractive and interesting Chims, all with green genetic clearances. Socially, it would be a very good move. But there were disadvantages as well. For one thing, he would have to move from Port Helena back out to the islands, where most of the Chim and human settlers still lived. Bibbin wasn't sure he was ready to do that. He liked the open spaces of the mainland, the freedom of mountains and wild Garth countryside. And there was another important consideration. Bibbin had to wonder whether the Throops wanted him because they really liked him, or because the Neo-Chimpanzee Uplift Board had granted him a blue card, an open breeding clearance. Only a white card was higher. Blue status meant he could join any marriage group and father children with only minimal genetic counseling. It couldn't help but have influenced the Throop clan's decision. "Oh, quit kidding yourself," he muttered at last. The matter was moot anyway. Right now, he wouldn't take long odds on his chances of ever even seeing home again alive.
"Bibbin, you still there, kid?"
"Yes, Simon. What you got?"
There was a pause.
"I just got a call from Major Forthness. He said he has an uneasy feeling about that gap in the fourth dodecant."
Bibbin yawned.
"Humans are always getting uneasy feelings, all the time worrying. That's what it's like being big-time patron types."
His partner laughed. On Garth it was fashionable, even for well-educated Chims, to talk grunt at times. Most of the better humans took the ribbing with good humor, and those who didn't could go chase themselves.
"Tell you what," he told Simon. "I'll drift over to the old fourth dodecant and give it a look over for the Major."
"We aren't supposed to split up,"
the voice in his headphones protested weakly. Still, they both knew having a wingman would hardly make any difference in the kind of fight they were about to face.
"I'll be back in a jiffy," Bibbin assured his friend. "Save me some of the bananas."
He engaged the stasis and gravity fields gradually, treating the ancient machine like a virgin chimmy on her first pink. Smoothly, the scout built up acceleration.